The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme.
If we don't have smart growth, intentional, purposeful growth at the local level or at the metropolitan scale, where's it going to come from?
This week, we go eclectic, bringing you a mix of some of the big stories that we've been working on for the past couple of weeks. We'll meet one of the authors behind a new book highlighting how cities and regions should take responsibility in achieving the development and change they want to see happening. Then, our Toronto bureau chief tells us the story behind one of the city's best-known murals and meets the man depicted in it too. Plus, understanding architecture through the eyes of one of the world's most renowned impressionist painters. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's episode of The Urbanist. The past year has really brought to light how cities are taking matters into their own hands. And we're not talking just about political activism. Across the US and Europe, cities have been using their cultural, educational and technological assets to attract investors and new residents alike. This is the starting point for the new book, The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism, co-authored by Bruce Katz and Jeremy Nowak. Earlier, I met with Bruce, who is the former chief of staff in housing and urban development in the first Obama administration, to talk about his idea of new localism and what are the key takeaways he's learnt from the cities that he's visited.
What Jeremy Nowak and I have put forward is the notion that there's a new philosophy and practice of problem solving in the 21st century. It's more bottom-up, led by cities, than top-down, driven by national governments. It's really designed by sectors of leaders from public, private, civic, university realms, rather than government alone. And it's interdisciplinary. It's matching up different expertise and experience so that when you're dealing with an economic or a social or an environmental challenge at a city, the stakeholders are coming at it from different perspectives, as opposed to a Department of Transportation or Department of Education, the typical 20th century compartmentalized approach. You know, when cities solve problems, it's different than when national governments solve problems. And that's what we're seeing more and more as the way of the world.
And that new localism then can cover everything from education, healthcare, housing. It could be any of the social issues that we care about in our cities.
Absolutely. When we wrote this book and the stories in our book around Pittsburgh or Indianapolis or even Copenhagen are really stories of economic growth, governance, finance. But since we've released this book, particularly in the United States, what has happened are a whole bunch of folks have come forward and said, you're describing how we deal with homelessness or the opioid crisis, other issues that bedevil cities on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. So we wrote this book thinking about economic development and inclusive growth, but a whole bunch of social issues are being dealt with by networks in the US as well.
Now, before we look at the meat of the book, let's just frame it one last time. So when we think about, for example, housing or something, we know that the city can do something about it. But in many of our cities, that role of providing housing has been farmed out to the private sector. So the city has given up its responsibility in a way. Is your book arguing that the city needs to reassert itself and reinsert itself in that conversation to say, we're the landowner here, we've got a bigger ambition here than you putting up some nice apartments that sell for a lot of money?
Well, what we're saying is, particularly for mature cities, and whether it's the United States or Europe or Australia or Canada, what we should be doing is looking across cities and trying to find the best way of grappling with a social or economic or environmental challenge, the challenge of housing. The best examples might be in a Germany or in a Denmark or in a Holland. And therefore, for American or British cities, what we should be thinking about is how are we cracking at this issue? And to what extent can we adapt and adopt some of the best innovations or practices that are emerging elsewhere in the world? So in an urban age, in a metropolitan century, we think what is going to emerge, already has emerged, are networks of cities that are really learning from each other and then much more capable of dealing with some of these hard issues because of broader economic restructuring, price effects on the housing market. I was just in Copenhagen last week. We're having a serious conversation about how to adapt various innovations in Copenhagen back into the United States, given the withdrawal of our national government and the hostility of many of our state governments.
So what did Copenhagen do well? In the book, you point out that in the 1980s, if you visited, you'd have found a city which was a little bit down on its luck. Cut to today, and as you say, it's seen as a livable city with a high quality of life, great for education. On the whole, it's done very well. So why did new localism work well there?
Copenhagen in the late 1980s looked a hell of a lot different than it does today. Double-digit unemployment. The city was essentially fiscally bankrupt. And the national government and the city government got together and said, we're going to have to make a major investment in infrastructure, a subway system for the 21st century, if we're going to restore the core and bring life and vitality and vibrancy back to the center of our city and metropolis. So what they did, and this is really the lesson, not just for the United States, but for the UK as well, they took all the land that the government owned between the airport and the downtown, the Ørestad district, and then they took all the land along the old harbor, because the harbor had lost its raison d'etre because most of the logistics was happening in Malmo, southern Sweden. And they put those assets under the control of a publicly owned, privately driven corporation. And what it basically said to this corporation, the Copenhagen City and Port Development Corporation, you go ahead and regenerate the Ørestad district and the harbor, but all the revenue from land sales and land leases has to go to service the debt on a modern subway system. The U.S., the U.K., we might be looking to national government or might be taxing our local citizens to build such a major infrastructure project. In Copenhagen, it's all being funded from land sales and land leases. This is public wealth being put to public use. So what we think the Copenhagen model says, if you get the mechanisms right, the structure right, you can capture the value when your economies are prospering and use the revenue, the yield from smart management to invest in housing or infrastructure or education for young children. Our cities are very wealthy, but they're not using that wealth to invest back in the public realm and in other core challenges.
Before we cross to the US, just tell me, both for the US and for Europe, is there a danger with new localism? Because if it's so invested at the local level and dependent on a mayor and what City Hall is doing, we know we have in many cities a shakeout every 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. Do you think those functions then need to sit in a body that's kind of outside of the political day-to-day, or do you just need to get the whole city kind of invested in the process?
I think what we're going to see in the next decade are the growth of institutions, some of which are public-private, like this Copenhagen City and Port. The public sector essentially is the chair of the board of the corporation, but the corporation is professionally managed. That's, I think, more of a European model. In the U.S., we more of a private-public model, where we have entities that are being formed by philanthropies and universities and corporations that are raising large amounts of capital for investing back in the city in concert with the government. So I think cities are not governments. I think cities are networks. They're networks of institutions and leaders from multiple sectors. In the next decade, I think we're going to realize that network effect and begin to finance and govern cities through a broader range of sectors and constituencies. And when you do it well, as in Copenhagen, or we do it well in the U.S., but mostly through the private side, St. Louis or Cincinnati or Indianapolis, you can have enormous amount of market capital and public capital go into what we would call transformative investments, 2 + 2 = 5. I think most American and British cities are not there yet, and therefore we really do need to learn these different models, different institutional ways of taking the network to full effect.
When we look from outside, we see many of these great American industrial cities who, for the last 2-3 decades, have really kind of struggled to find their way forward and their purpose in a way. And now we're seeing some cities rise out from the crowd as really strong examples of what you can do. So Pittsburgh, for example, it's had a very positive story and has managed to attract high-tech companies who have given it a bit of a shine of late. I know you're saying it's cities networking for best examples and it's across institutions. But before we dwell on their story, just again, tell us, what did Pittsburgh do right that it managed to pull ahead of, yes, other loyal cities, but competitor cities in a sense as well?
Well, I think Pittsburgh has made some smart, future-oriented investments from the public, private, and civic side for decades, particularly in centers of excellence at Carnegie Mellon University and the University of Pittsburgh, which are their two jewels, and in next-generation technologies. So artificial intelligence, robotics, autonomous vehicles, big data analytics, machine learning, genomics. Frankly, technologies that 20 years or 30 years ago, we didn't really have names for. But Pittsburgh was investing in their universities in a way saying, at some point, we're going to move from basic science to applied research to commercialization to companies. And when that happens, we want to be on the ground floor. Because any city that's on the ground floor of a next generation technology is going to have a several generation run in terms of not just technology jobs, but all the indirect benefits from technology growth and deployment. So Pittsburgh bet on the future, and they bet on the future with a public-private civic network, and that's now coming to fruition. It's now a playground of innovation, essentially. Now, Manchester could be this. Sheffield could be this. I mean, when I think about Britain and your great universities that are sort of spread and dispersed through the country and the ecosystems of companies and entrepreneurs that gravitate around those universities, that's basically what Pittsburgh did. What Pittsburgh also benefited from is that the geography of innovation in the world today is centered around these advanced universities and companies. It's not dispersed into science parks and business parks and research centers that are all isolated. It's all mashed up, essentially, in the cores of cities and conurbations. Pittsburgh did not know that was coming, that market dynamic was coming, but they bet on the future. They've been revalued because of the geography of their core universities.
Finally, perhaps you could just tell me what the challenges are for new localism. The way you describe it is a win-win for everybody and it should just be storming ahead. But actually, even a city like Pittsburgh, you see that many people, even in recent months, have been saying, there's this whole kind of new tech thing happening. I don't feel part of the story. Are these young kids coming in and taking over our city? I don't see my old job coming back. I'm not invested in the process. Does new localism have to explain itself and somehow be a bit more of a community base as well as just a way of building stuff and doing things?
Well, first of all, new localism emerges and occurs at all levels, in all geographies. So it frankly starts at the block level in many American cities, at the neighborhood level, dealing with many of the issues that obviously concern that area. When it gets to this economy shaping, we make the case that a large number of jobs in this next generation economy don't require 4-year degrees. They really require certain kinds of credentials and technology skills, which could be learned in our high schools or our technical institutes, community colleges. So if you just let the market play itself out, yes, we're not going to really match a lot of people to the opportunities. But if you can align your schools and skills system, particularly when you have such distinctive advantages and attributes like a Pittsburgh does, you can bring a lot of people along for the ride. The other issue is if we don't have smart growth, intentional, purposeful growth at the local level or at the metropolitan scale, where's it going to come from? The national government, like Elvis, has left the building in the United States. I mean, there's no purpose there. And most of our states have had a lobotomy. So the local is where it's going to happen. And I think we just need to join up economy shaping, talent preparing, placemaking in this synergistic way.
Bruce Katzer, the co-author of The New Localism, and the book is out now. Now, on The Urbanist, we often look at our cities through the eyes of planners, architects, mayors, and even city aficionados. But in the 19th century, the way we used to be introduced to cities around the world was through the eyes of travelling artists, delivering onto their canvases their impressions of capitals far and away. Claude Monet, considered the father of French Impressionist painting, was no exception. Currently at the National Gallery here in London, visitors can enjoy an exhibition that zooms in on the painter's relationship with architecture, featuring 75 of his paintings. Monocle's Yoline Goffin went down to the museum to discover the late 19th century versions of London, Venice and Paris through the eyes of this artist.
When we think of the paintings of Claude Monet, typically we think of gardens, of water lilies, of beautiful bridges under weeping willows. But in the current exhibition at the National Gallery in London, Monet and Architecture, we see another side of the Impressionist painter's oeuvre.
It's remarkable that Monet had a career spanning 60 years, and for 50 years of those, he was repeatedly painting a real variety of buildings, from the most humble cabins on the edge of a cliff through to Rouen Cathedral. And he's using them in very different ways.
That's Rosalind McKeever, curatorial fellow at the National Gallery.
It's not necessarily about the characteristic of the architecture, but it's what the architecture can do for the structure, for the colour, for the balance of his painting. For example, when he travels to Bordighera, which is on the Italian Riviera, it's a sort of new tourist town, he paints not only the Città Alta, the old city of Bordighera, but also the new palace that had been built, and he uses that and plays those two structures off against each other. Another thing he does often is use colour. So, for example, red roofs of buildings is something that plays against the green of a landscape to give him a real exciting colour palette in a picture.
So, for Monet, architecture serves his painting. Through buildings and bridges, we can identify the location of the landscapes he painted. We recognise a village by its church or a city by its famous bridge. But it also aided Monet with composition, colour and interesting surfaces on which to play with light, a technique he became famous for.
He's interested in Paris from the late 1860s through to the late 1870s. So it's a sort of 10-year period where he's looking at Paris, which of course is being redeveloped by Baron Haussmann, and this very new exciting period for the city. And he's painting that repeatedly and seeking out these modern locations. So, for example, he's painting in the Boulevard Capuchin, where he's using the street furniture that he finds there to structure his picture in a very confusing way that leads your eye through the space.
Monet's fascination with the architecture of the new modernity, of rapidly industrializing cities like Paris and London, only lasted a decade. After that period, we encounter more personal impressions of how Monet wanted us to see the city, or at least how he wanted to see it. And, as artistic freedom allows, he occasionally applied the art of editing.
He painted what he wanted to paint. So, for example, with the London pictures, when he's painting Charing Cross Bridge, from his view in the Savoy Hotel, Cleopatra's Needle is in the way. So he only includes it in two of the very many pictures he does of that scene. In the others, he completely edits it out. And we're very fortunate to have one of the pictures with Cleopatra's Needle in the show. But even with that picture, you can see that it's still in quite a sketchy state. He hasn't finished it off completely because you can see that he's not happy with that architectural inclusion within the work.
But even beyond editing the views, when we really start getting a glimpse of the city through Monet's eyes, is when he starts painting the cities of London, Rouen and Venice. Here he uses buildings for different purposes. So what are they, and what do they reveal about Monet's relationship to these cities? Here's Rosalind again.
In Paris, he's focusing on modern life. You get a lot of people in the Parisian pictures who are moving around often. You see them at speed. You get a sense that they're walking through the city. He's also painting train stations, so he's interested in how people are moving around the city in that way. With London, his interest seems to be more around the air in London, the fog, the smog, of course, in that period, and how that affects the colour and light that he sees when he's here. So we see it in a very grey, foggy tones of The Thames Below Westminster, a painting he makes in probably early 1871. But we see this really comes to life around the turn of the century when he comes back to London, stays at the Savoy, and makes the more colourful, very evocative paintings of the effect of colour, of light on the water of the Thames. Then finally there's Venice, where he travels in 1908, and completely unlike Paris, where the pictures are filled with people, in Venice there's hardly anyone there, which is an extraordinary thing, because in this period in Venice it was absolutely chock-a-block with tourists. So the idea that he's completely cut the people out gives a more mysterious, a very strange, otherworldly quality to those pictures, where he's going back to something he's done throughout his life, something he's done in London, where he's painting buildings reflected in water. So at the top half of the canvas, you have this very solid structure that he's producing, and then underneath it, a far more fluid, broken up, reflected version of that same building.
These paintings, representations of cities and their famous architecture, evoke a mood, eerie atmospheres that, while not realist portrayals of that city, tell a much richer story for the viewer.
A report there by Monocle's Yoline Goffin. The exhibition, Monet and Architecture, is still on at the National Gallery until the end of July. This is The Urbanist, and next, a little newsflash of our own. I'm going to let you into a secret. After a decade plus reporting on urbanism and over 340 episodes of The Urbanist, we're busy at work on a new book that will bring together many of the stories that we've told, the people we've met, and the pioneers who have inspired us. Due for publication this summer, it's a hefty endeavour that we hope will deliver a more human, achievable, and inspiring take on life in our cities. Because over all of these episodes of The Urbanist, we've tried to wrest the debate about cities away from the academics and the fanatics who glaze every issue with some sciencey words and who would rather talk about public realm than parks and who focus on smart cities and box-fresh technology rather than the simple fixes that can immediately shift your quality of life. And it struck us that we could produce a book that would act as a global tour of best practice and also as a modest manifesto for change, and one that could assist regular citizens who care about where they live. We're going to tell you more in the coming weeks, but this is also by way of thanks to you for all your ideas and suggestions over the past few years. Look out this summer, because there's going to be a nice book heading to your bookshelves. Murals can be something of a love or hate feature of a city. To some, they're the product of an area or neighbourhood in disrepair where would-be artists can daub and experiment with few repercussions. To others, they can speak to the vibrancy of an urban centre's shifting, impromptu artistic sensibilities. Well, for Monocle's bureau chief in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, one of the city's latest unsung murals speaks to the city's rapid transformation and celebrates the simplicity of life that rapid development can often erode.
I went to one of my favourite coffee shops the other day, a quick pit stop on a round of pretty uninspiring Saturday afternoon errand running in Toronto's West End. I stepped through the door of the cafe, and from behind the counter, the barista walked towards me, wished me a good afternoon, and asked me what I'd like. His face was immediately familiar, although I knew we'd never met nor spoken before. As I mused on what kind of coffee I had an appetite for, I was distracted by the familiar face to whom I owed an answer. The sounds of the busy Saturday afternoon coffee shop crowd bubbling on around us. His face was young, but ageless, his dark eyes waiting patiently as I made up my mind. His skin was pale and like unvarnished porcelain, all framed by an unwieldy back-combed mass of long black hair. "Do you mind me asking?" I said, tentatively. But you're in the mural at the mouth of Kensington Market, aren't you? Yes, he replied, it's me. He proceeded to tell me the story of how he came to be the centrepiece of one of the most poetic pieces of street art, in my view anyway, to have appeared in Toronto for quite some time. He and some friends were whiling away the evening hours on a rooftop in nearby Kensington Market, he said, one of Toronto's most eclectic neighbourhoods, home to homespun cafes and bakeries, vintage shops, fruit and vegetable stands, and a rowdy roster of unpretentious music bars. A member of the group, the barista told me, someone he'd never met before, asked him if he could take his photo. It was only months later when another friend excitedly got in touch, he told me, that he found out that the photograph taken on the roof that day would be the subject for the latest mural by Jarrus, one of Toronto's more enigmatic muralists, who made a name for himself in daubing figurative renderings of Torontonians in unlikely corners of the city. The mural in question is at the opening to Kensington Market, one of Toronto's most colourful and, frankly, peculiar neighbourhoods, a remarkably untouched bubble within touching distance of the ever-rising glass towers of downtown. The mural depicts the barista alone, sitting on a rooftop, looking up and out into the distance, eyes wide, mouth slightly open, in a suggestion of wonder, lips curling slightly upwards into something resembling an amazed smile. It's unclear what time of day it is in the mural. The sun could be setting or it could just be raising its head. A nod, maybe, to the unpredictable, carefree routines of those that frequent or live in Kensington Market below. His eyes seem a little red, bleary by a night's festivities, perhaps, or bloodshot by having just woken up to soak in the sunrise. He's dressed in an oversized blue sweater, which the artist has rendered in soft-edged triangles, giving the boy on the roof a somewhat fantastic edge. Again, a nod, in my eye, to the blurred, often heady realities that are a staple of the comings and goings of the market below. But the mural also speaks to a sense of simplicity, something that urban life in a city as big as Toronto can often make hard to find, and something that Kensington Market, which the mural is a figurative welcome in sign to, still embodies so boisterously. Toronto is growing quickly. It's arguably becoming a more complicated place to live. The boy on the roof is a symbol of simpler pleasures, soaking up a city's changing face from a surprising, unorthodox vantage point, not adhering to the prescriptions this fledgling metropolis is laying down for those who call it home. Back at the coffee shop, I chose my coffee and thanked the barista come street art celebrity for the chat. As I moved towards the door to head on my way, I asked him if other people had recognised him since the mural had been completed late last year. Yes, he said. People come and track me down all the time. It's kind of crazy.
Monocle's bureau chief, Thomas Lewis, there. And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rabello and it was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's the XX with Basic Space. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.